Have you ever wondered why is it so hard to talk about abuse when it happens to boys or men? Stick to find out. Welcome to the Reflection Room. My name is Sandra, and I am a licensed mental health counselor.
My name is Natalie Rosato, and I am also a licensed mental health counselor.
And I'm Hannah. I'm also a licensed mental health counselor. And today we're following up on our series of looking at different cultural events and popular shows. Last time we watched a couple clips from the show Shrinking and talked about that from our point of view as licensed mental health counselors. And today we're going to be looking at the Menendez brothers. So a little bit darker, but we want to try and get a lot of different topics.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you mentioned, Hannah, that it is a little bit darker for sure. And in some ways, I think I was not necessarily dreading, but I guess we would all agree that it's not a topic that we necessarily enjoy talking about, but it's definitely a topic I think that it's important to talk about for sure. And I think you brought up a good point. So today we're going to talk about it from a different angle, right? So it's not so much like whether or not like their charges should change or whether or not they necessarily did it or didn't, but it's more so like talking about the sexual abuse that they described occurred to them and really discussing sexual abuse and what that looks like in boys and really how far we've come and recognizing it and discussing like the symptoms and the impact that it has on children. So hopefully this could be a video that helps a lot of people in, yeah, just recognizing it, understanding it, and maybe even feeling comfortable discussing it and disclosing it with loved ones they feel comfortable with.
Hopefully it normalizes it a little bit.
Yeah. By the way, before we start, someone who watched our shrinking video said that it was really interesting to hear our perspective as therapists. Yeah, like when like they're not a therapist at all. And so they were saying it was really interesting to hear it from like a different perspective or whatever. So I thought that was really cool. So I really enjoyed doing that. I don't know if you guys did.
Yeah, that was so much fun. I think everyone should go back and watch that one for some laughs after this.
Laughs for sure. Yeah. Awesome. All right. So are you guys ready?
Yes.
Okay. And we have not seen these clips at all. So we had someone do them for us. So we're definitely reacting to them in the moment. All right, here we go.
The myths back then about who a sex offender was didn't fit the Menendez family. And a powerful, highly successful executive was not looked upon as the kind of person who would sexually abuse their children. But looking at these attractive, dressed white guys just doesn't match the public's perception of what a victim should look like. And therefore, there's a natural tendency to discount it. It just doesn't fit with how we think of privileged people.
My worst fear came to pass when we made the mistake of taking a show of hands. All of the men raised their hands in favor of first degree murder, and none of the women raised their hands. So I knew that we had a battle on our hands, a battle of the sexes.
The men instantly voted for murder.
I think the men had a really hard time accepting the fact that a young man could possibly be abused by his father. And the women were more empathetic in terms of understanding issues of abuse.
All right, where do we start? Ugh. I feel
Yeah,
like,
there's a lot.
yeah, right. It's so interesting. I don't know if you guys feel this way, but I feel like sometimes this is obvious, but I feel like sometimes I'll watch something or I'll hear something or even observe interactions, like, yeah, just like outside. And I feel like I look at it through a different lens than the people that I'm like out with, whether it's like family or loved ones or friends. And yeah, I feel like we look at something like this that I'm obviously has talks about a lot of heavy topics, but I feel like for us, like all these things just jump up for us even more. But yeah, what were you guys' thoughts, initial thoughts?
I noticed that at least there are two dynamics. The first one is the unfortunate silence that happens within families, which in a way, it helps to perpetuate the abuse, especially when the person is a powerful person, a powerful figure. And the second one is this cultural stigma about the perception that men and boys cannot be victims, or that they should not, or that they should actually endure abuse without complaining. Boys don't cry, you have to toughen up. That's very harmful, and we can see that happening here. That's what I captured from the video.
Yeah, absolutely. And to think that lady in the second video, she said that all of the men raised their hands in favor of charging them with murder. The possible chance that those men either have been personally impacted by SA, or they possibly know someone that has been. And if there wasn't such a stigma, or especially at that time, for men to remain silenced by that, who knows how many men in that room would not have raised their hand so quickly. And so that shows the ripple effects that silence has, like not only on individuals who feel the need to remain silenced, but also the impact that it has on like their families, their friends. And now we're looking at something on a more like systemic level, like decisions that are being made for like other people's lives, unfortunately.
Yeah, and talking about systemic issues, they were talking about the perception of a family like that. Like the dad was very wealthy, very successful, powerful man. And so no one suspected that anything would be wrong. And you hear this a lot with CCF investigators when they go into the home and it looks pristine. Everything's clean. There's no damages. Like they look like they live in a safe household. They'll just go on their way because there's other cases that they may need to get to. But that's just their perception of the family in that moment, when in reality, it doesn't matter. Predators don't discriminate. They will, it's about availability for them. So, and if they want to keep it a secret, they will. They're very good at keeping it secret. So, in this case, he's a powerful man, two white boys. They didn't expect two white boys to be abused. So that everybody on the outside is looking in like, how could this happen? And that's the more systemic problem that's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think about as therapists, there have been times, at least for myself, where I've come across clients who have shared, I didn't speak up because I didn't think anyone would believe me. You hear that time and time again. And then you add the additional layer of the perpetrator being the person, a parental figure, a person who is supposed to be the protector, which is the person who you would think a child who's. And then in addition to that, then I believe in this case, you also have a mother who I believe may have been deemed as like an alcoholic. So another person who's also not safe in the home. And then you have the people on the outside. So like their community, their network, their friends, who knows what other communities these people were a part of because of their like socioeconomic status, that would never have thought that something like that would be happening. So you think about how unprotected, how isolated these boys must have felt at that point in time. And who really would they go to if you think about it?
And kids in that situation take on the responsibility for the whole family. So they see it as, if I tell, my family's going to fall apart. If I tell, where do I live? If I tell, do my parents get divorced? If they tell, their whole world is destroyed. So they carry this burden on their shoulders. And then they also worry, if they do tell and they're not believed, how much trouble are they going to get in? There's just so much that a kid has to think about, and they shouldn't have to think about that stuff.
Starting with this dissonance of, this is the person that is supposed to protect me. This is the person that is supposed to love me. And so how do I make sense of what's happening? And I don't know who said this, if it was you, Natalie Ohana, but is going inwardly. What am I doing wrong? What's wrong about me that this is happening? So sadly, those things happen in a child's mind. But it's terrible how eventually it devolves into, if I say something, no one will believe me. So now you add the invalidation of what's happening to me is not valid enough to be able to speak up. because no one will believe me.
Yeah, exactly. And I think about both of you guys have touched upon this, but if they're unable to have any positive outlets for all that they're carrying, you think about like, where is that emotional baggage going? And it's just being contained internally. They did at one point have each other in some sense, but there were even some things I believe that might have even been going on between themselves at some point. But you think about like, where is that emotional, kind of baggage going? And so I know we're not here to diagnose or anything like that, but sometimes in some cases, there is a level of like detachment or numbness that begins to happen. And because, and I think that sometimes people like wonder, how can someone get to that point where there's such aggression or such anger, or it's at such extreme levels where something like that can happen? And I know there's so many factors that are wrapped up in this case, but just thinking about just a child that is experiencing SA like that at that level and not having anybody to protect them, there is sometimes a level of detachment and numbness that begins to occur where they begin to, you know, not feel anything, because to feel something is to really experience so much pain and so much hurt. That's unbearable for any person, let alone any child, to really experience.
And that's how a lot of those dissociative disorders come about, because they detach, they dissociate when it's happening, and even like turns into multiple personality disorder, where they create other personalities to guard themselves, to protect themselves. And then it goes into adulthood like that. So that's how a lot of childhood experience translates into adulthood problems.
And when you think about it, it actually becomes their coping mechanisms, whether it is adaptive or maladaptive, it's still a coping. It's a way to cope with what's happening to them.
Yeah, exactly. What do you guys think is leading, not to say that we've arrived, because I don't think we have, but what do you think has led to there being, I guess, a deeper understanding of like boys and men that they do in fact experience SA, and sometimes maybe at just as high rates as women and girls? And yeah, and there being like understanding trainings for that, just a deeper awareness and more people talking about that. What do you think is leading to that?
One thought I had, and this is just a small part of it, but I think more well-known people, men especially, are coming out with what's happened to them. Two examples off the top of my head are Terry Crews and Brendan Fraser. Too, Terry Crews, I think, was in the NFL, but is also an actor. Brendan Fraser was a very popular actor. And they both came out and said that I can't remember if it was a director or producer, had sexually assaulted them in their line of work. And it was a huge controversy. But I think strong masculine men like that coming out and saying, yeah, this did happen to me too, and it can happen to men, has allowed other men to say, I can let that out now. Like, I can get help. Because they even struggle just going to therapy for it. Like, men struggle just to acknowledge it in therapy, where it's a one-on-one situation. It's not going anywhere. It's like confidentiality, but they still have trouble saying it out loud in that way because they're so afraid of what it means.
Yeah, I agree. A person that comes to mind, and I'm 99% positive that this has been a part of his like story. I think it's Tyler Perry might be someone too that has expressed that. But also, I think with the increase in like even like streaming platforms, where they have an increase in like documentaries, and so you hear a lot more about these major, like these large situations that have occurred with Boy Scouts or even with the Catholic Church. And I think it's provided platforms for a lot of these places or people or organizations to speak up and say, this is my story and this is what's happened to me. And you're right. It's then given other people, I guess, either the green light or the level of comfort to say, yeah, me too. Where before, like without social media, without these streaming platforms, and it's hard to know that I'm not the only one that's experienced something like this. Yeah.
That might be a pro to social media.
Yeah.
There's a few of those.
And of course, it goes back to also believing their stories, right? And providing a safe space for them to talk, which we've been talking about how difficult it is and this stigma that when we talk about providing the safe space and believing the story, is usually associated with a woman, but is actually extending it, opening up to men and believing their stories and being able to provide that space for them to process that, to talk about it.
Yeah, actually. And as you're saying that, Xander, I want to say, I don't know, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the things that came up with this case is that with one of the brothers, and I can't remember which one, I guess he didn't, one of the things against their case is that he didn't disclose in counseling that he had been experiencing like SA in the home. And so a lot of people were saying if that really had occurred, don't you think he would have at some point brought that up in counseling? But we know that I don't know. What is, let me ask it in a question. Have you guys ever been sitting across from a client and that there's something that needs to be shared or something that needs to be said? And sometimes I know it. And I'm waiting for them to say it. Sometimes they don't know it, but I know there's something, and they just haven't shared it for whatever reason. Have you guys ever experienced that? And what is that like for you? Or sometimes a client will share things like after we've been working together for a year and a half, but it's like, wow, that would have helped me like a year ago everything. It's vulnerability is so difficult for us to be able to. Yeah, to build and develop with another human being. And yeah, especially around topics like this. So, like, what are your guys' experiences with that?
Yeah, I've definitely experienced that, and it's like you said, when they reveal something after a year and a half of working together, that is frustrating, but I also understand that it's scary. I'm just some stranger that you see once a week, maybe once every other week, and expect to you to share everything with me. So that I see the fear in that, and they have to build that level of trust with you too. So I get it, but it is frustrating.
Yeah, and I think it's it happens a lot when, I don't know about you guys, but when they comment, how have you been? Good. No, have you really? Exactly. And it's one of those moments when those opportunities, those are the opportunities where I actually say, I know it must be very hard to talk about sensitive issues. You just know me, or you just we've been working for I don't know, maybe a year and a half, and it still takes time because think about it. We're also talking about trust. They've been betrayed, their trust has been broken. And so, who is to say that they feel safe with us and that we are going to be there for them? That's very challenging for them to believe that. I think that reminding them that, hey, I know this must be very hard. And just being consistent with them is one of the things that is going to help them to open up.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to share like what it's like on the other side, because there have been a few times where clients have said, I was embarrassed to share it, or I felt ashamed, or I didn't know like how you were going to react. And sometimes it's because other people have reacted negatively, maybe to what they sh shared when they've shared it with them. But there have been times where people have shared things with me and have even said, the only person that knows. And actually, it feels like it's a special moment. There really isn't any judgment that occurs in that moment, or they walk in and I have a perspective of them and then they leave and I have a different perspective of them. It all does not occur in those sessions. If anything, it's wow, I'm glad that they feel comfortable enough to be able to share that and to know that they no longer have to carry that alone in life moving forward. And sometimes I wish that they can feel what I feel in those moments or know what I'm thinking in those moments to know that what they think I'm thinking is not at all the case. It's actually a special moment when a client exposes.
I've actually dove into that with clients before where they'll say, I like they'll share something, or maybe before they share something, they'll say they're afraid of how I'll see them, or that it'll change the way I see them. So I'll dive into that with them and explain like unconditional positive regard. Like my feelings for you don't change no matter what you tell me. When they do that, I try to make them feel a little bit more comfortable with that. But even then, I've still had clients that will share with me their deepest, darkest secret, most vulnerable moment, and then not come back because it's their own perception of me judging them, even though I'm not judging them. Like I want them to feel safe and comfortable, but they're so afraid. And then they hit that moment and they're like, oh, I can't go back. So I've had a couple of those before too. And it breaks my heart because I do feel that honor. Like it's a very special moment for me to be able to hold that with you. But then you don't come back and it's very sad.
I agree. And then you just hope at some point, that there's a level of comfortability again to continue to process, whether it's with you or with someone else on the road.
One thing that I noticed, and I don't know what you guys think, but sometimes going back with to what you were saying, Hannah, is this fear of being judged, right? And so I remember I had a professor at school that used to say, "We don't judge." And as a student, you're studying like, how this is going to be very hard, right? And that's part of what we learn actually in school. And that's how we start. I don't know, I don't want to speak for you guys, so that's why I'm asking about your experience. But I got to a point where I also noticed when I tell a client, what you share with me is actually information. There is no judgment. It's information that helps me to know how can I help you better? How can I show up for you in a much better way? It's actually true. I was like, wow, my professor was, it's not judgment because I'm actually more interested on knowing how can I be here for you? How can I support you? And I have moments when I have apologized to my client for something they have endured. And just saying, if no one or the person who did this to you hasn't said so, I want you to know I am sorry for this happening. And it really helps the therapeutic alliance by being able to maybe share a little bit as to why or how we use that information. There is no judgment, and it's just to know how we can help them better. And it really is. I can genuinely say that it has helped me tremendously to frame it that way. So what do you guys think about that?
Actually, as you were talking about like the no judgment and reframing your brain, like during grad school with that, I was thinking about, have you guys seen those TikToks where it's a therapist running from a serial killer and they turn around and they're like, but wait, what happened to you in your childhood? And I think that it's true. Like I remember when I was in supervision with you, Natalie, and I got jury duty. You were telling me that therapists often don't get picked for jury duty because we just see all sides of it. Like, I imagine being on the case, like in this trial with the Menendez brothers, I wouldn't be able to convict them because I'd know what happened in their childhood, even if they're guilty. Like, how can you treat somebody like that? So, I think from a therapist's point of view, it's so hard to judge people because we see all different sides.
Absolutely. It really is. Like I think that's what makes, I love all this. Okay, so my mind's like going in different directions. I think that's what makes counseling effective is that we're able to see the symptoms of whatever the situation is, like the issues, and recognize, that is unhealthy, but then we don't stop there. We have this like curiosity and this desire to figure out what's caused that and to try to help a client like organize that piece of their life, as opposed to what most people do in today's society, which is look at the chaos of the symptoms and they just stay there and cast judgment. And there's no way I could have sat on that jury and raised my hand. And you know what's crazy is that Did you guys know that there were a few, what do you call them, hearings and stuff like that? And then in the last one, they actually said they could not talk about any of the essay stuff that went on, which it just it saddens me. It's like saying, it's like having a child brought into our counseling room who is, I'm watering it down, but who's misbehaving, and to not be able to ask what's going on in the home. Or what, how, what's the relationship like between the parents? I just, we wouldn't be able to like fully treat a child without asking all of these other questions and taking all of that into consideration. Yeah, it's just very saddening when I think about that. But I was going to say, Zandra, to your point about what makes it like the impact of like our being just like non-judgmental. There is this quote sometimes that I'll use in our in counseling sessions. And I know I don't quote it the way that it's like the way I don't quote it properly, but it's something like healing oftentimes doesn't come from the source of pain or something like that. Because, and I think that because I think that's what people sometimes, especially with these kinds of topics, people will come into our counseling room and want closure or want healing from the person that maybe caused the pain or caused whatever that was. And oftentimes that doesn't occur, but I think we have the opportunity to help provide that kind of healing or help accompany them on that journey to healing. And help them recognize that they might be reaching for healing in the wrong place, recognizing that they're not going to get it from the person or this. And so, yeah, and that's why I'm such an advocate for counseling. Hopefully I am, right?
You are 100%. Yeah, and this is going with going back to the judging and sharing, because at the end of the day, the whole idea is to provide a safe space, right, for people to discuss what's happening in their lives. One of the reasons why I share, well, actually, why I share with my clients to be careful with whom they share, it's because sometimes we all have those well-intended friends who want to protect us. So when we share something, a person who has already experienced trauma, they are so in tune with reading body language, with reading words, or even the ones that are not said. So they either will pull back or feel judged or feel shame, even if the other person didn't intend to do that. But it's normal to have that reaction. And so I think as therapists, and going back to what you were saying, Natalie, why therapy works, is because our brain has been wired differently. This is information that I'm going to take so that I can show up in a much better way for you. And I think sometimes is the difference between a friend who says, I am here to protect you, and that's horrible, and this and that, as opposed to I'm here to help you in your journey. I don't know, what's your take on this?
No, I love that, because I'm thinking about like all the friends and family I've had where they've been with somebody through some trauma or grief, and they say, I just don't know what to say, or I don't know how to help them. But we do. Like in a situation like that, we'll lean in, whereas somebody like that might pull away a little bit because they feel self-conscious about what they're saying. So when you're talking to or trying to trust or open up with the layperson, like just your friend or family member, they may not react the way that you need them to, but that's also not your fault. It's not about you. It's just because they feel uncomfortable. And most people do feel uncomfortable when they hear these things. So you're right. I think it's really important to know who you're talking to and to be careful about who you share these things with.
Yeah, I agree with, yeah, I definitely agree with both of you guys. And I think also like they drilled, at least in our program, they drilled in our heads about like how 90% of communication or 95% or something like that of communication is like nonverbal cues or something like that. So I think that we also are trained to pick up on moments when things that we say or do in response to what a client says wasn't received well. And like friends and loved ones may not pick up on that. Like it just might go way, like it's just over their head. And they may not, like unintentionally, may not recognize that. And like you said, Sandra, like people that have gone through trauma are hypersensitive to things. And so they might take a look or a comment or something like that. Yeah, a little bit more sensitive. And so, and there have been times in sessions where I know I've said something or, and where a client has, yeah, it's just, maybe it's either caused a little bit of hurt or maybe disappointment, or it's left them confused about something. And I think we're able to recognize, oh, I think I need to clarify that, or I think I need to ask a follow-up question or something like that, where loved ones may not even recognize it. It's just like, they just keep on with the conversation and not realize that, yeah, they left an open wound there.
Speaking of like the therapist side, Eric Menendez's therapist, I don't know if you guys saw that part. He actually recorded their confession and then blackmailed them. And then his, I guess, mistress, whoever he was having an affair with at the time, went to the police. She took the recording to the police. What do you guys think about that?
I'm like, I don't know, Xandra, what do you think about that? Toss it over.
Oh, horrible, right? Such a break. See, we're talking about trust and betrayal and all of this happening there, not only the action that happened, but how it continues to happen. So no wonder when they show up to therapy, if they actually show up, they have a tough time trusting us. This is terrible. Yeah.
I don't know. Here's the thing. I think that he was threatened, right?
He was what?
He was threatened. His life was threatened, the therapist.
By the Menendez? I think Lyle came in. Yeah, Lyle came in after he found out that Eric had confessed.
Yeah, so I think that's what happened. And then he started recording the sessions. I think that was the order of things. This is a sticky one. One of the things that I find myself, not like this, but I think sometimes we find ourselves as therapists facing certain situations where it's, we don't know like what the right call is, or there's a bit of a gray area, or sometimes it's, do I make a report? Do I not make a report? Or never to this extent. I don't know. But I wonder, I put myself in the therapist's shoes, and it's, if I got threatened by a client, which thank God that's not been the case, but what do you do in a case like that? And what would be considered a breach of confidentiality? What's not? Or like, how do you share? How much do you not share? I think it's, those are the situations that I think the lines aren't very clear, maybe. And so I wonder, was he just protecting himself? I don't know. I go back and forth with that situation. I definitely think recording sessions without a client being aware is like unethical. Details with another person, like his mistress, definitely unethical. His life was threatened by someone who killed his parents. So we know he would do it. It's not just an empty threat. So yeah, that's a tough situation. I don't know how I would handle something like that.
I don't know either, because, you know, we have the duty to warn, which that has been drilled into us. And that came from a case, I think, in California, where a guy was stalking a girl and talked to his therapist about it, and then he ended up killing the girl. But the therapist should have gone to authorities. Now that's a huge law. But how would that go after the fact? If you found out somebody had murdered someone, do you report that? Because that seems complicated.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't
really.
I don't think you report if it's something that's been, I don't think so, if it's a crime that's already been committed. I think if it's, if someone's, yeah, like a duty to warn, something like that. So for example, I think if a client were to like threaten us I think the answer would be like maybe going to like authorities and just mentioning that's occurred and then not sharing any unnecessary details. I think is really what that's supposed to look like. And that would not include sharing details that this same client also has like committed murder. But I don't know. I think I would have to like maybe look that up. That would be the answer. I
Well,
think.
thank goodness that obviously hasn't happened to any of us.
No, but I think we do have a duty to report, right? But in this case, or what you were talking about, Hannah, is the mistress actually had the tapes, right? Like it wasn't that he volunteered these tapes. It's actually that the mistress had the tapes. And that's what I say, how a big mess, because it wasn't the therapist going directly. It was another person who had no business in knowing what was happening there. She wasn't the right person to know. So I think that's also super important to remember that as therapists, we don't share these things with an external person who has nothing to do with our duty to report. We go straight to where we need to go, where we need to do it. But yeah, doing it or talking about it with someone else is such a betrayal for them. I just wonder that when they saw that the Menendez brothers, how betrayed they felt, that it wasn't the therapist who knew about it, but also someone else about the whole situation. Yeah.
Yeah. So you think about the people that were supposed to like be there. I think you used the word safe space earlier, Sandra. So it's like their home and the counseling room. And all both of those spaces were like, yeah, we're not safe spaces for them ultimately. So yeah, you're right. I think betrayal was like the perfect word for that. Absolutely. I think in the end he lost his license, right?
Yes,
I
I
think
think
so.
so.
And now that I think about it, because Eric had been going to this therapist, and Eric was the one who was abused up until the point of the murder. So he was like going to college and he was going to this therapist, but the dad was paying the therapist and needed rundowns of every session. So the therapist and the dad were talking, so he couldn't tell the therapist. So I think there's also that mistrust that was broken. Like he couldn't tell his therapist because his therapist would just tell the dad what he said.
That's like a whole nother layer there, right? Especially if he's an adult. Yeah. So these are a lot of flags, but I think it's important to talk about them because if any of these things are occurring, it's like it's not a healthy relationship between a therapist and a client. These are things that should not be happening. Yeah. This was an interesting case. It really was. And I think, yeah, I don't know. It pulls out a lot of heartstrings for sure. And I don't know if you guys saw like some of the footage from like the court meetings and things like that, but I don't know. Very sad, all in all.
It is.
Yeah. Anything else you guys want to share?
Well, here's a question for you, which from a therapist perspective, what did you do when you have, so we're talking about how we are mandated to keep privacy and confidentiality. So how do you handle it when you hear something so heavy, which happens to all of us? And all of us therapists, at least, and you hear something heavy and you know that you cannot share that with anybody. How do you process that for yourself when you feel, because you feel the pain, like you sit with them in their pain. And so how do you process that for yourself?
That's a really good question, Sandra. Yeah, I don't know if you want me to go first, Hannah, or
I actually talk about it with my therapist, and it's not necessarily about the case, like what the person, my client went through, but more so how I'm dealing with it. So I don't share details of the person or identifying information, even though she can't tell anybody either because she's my therapist. So it just like stays within this chain of confidentiality. But I'll talk to her about how I'm dealing, and she'll help me process the feelings I have associated with it. Because you're right, like we do feel it. Like we feel everything that they're feeling in the room. And sometimes we can't just let that go in 50 minutes. Sometimes you gotta process it on your own.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Yeah, if I'm being honest, I think it like ebbs and flows, if I'm being like 100% honest. I think that they're when I'm personally not taking care of like myself, like I thrive in routine and structure. So when that is off and I'm not doing the things that kind of refuel me. And I'm an introvert, so I love my alone time. So, like, when I'm not doing those things that I already know are good for me, I could feel the heaviness of the day's conversations. And that just c continues to pile up until I feel like I find myself beginning to isolate, not really wanting to talk to people, getting a little bit like snippy with the people in my personal life. And I already begin to notice, like, oh, this is not good. And so, and sometimes like life, I'll go through a season like that, and then and then I realize, oh, I need to get back to a healthy place. And so that's when, yeah. And so to answer your question, in those healthy moments, for me, I thrive in routine. And yeah, just making sure that I'm doing those things that bring me joy and bring me a sense of peace and calmness, because a lot of times the opposite is happening in those sessions. Even though it's very quiet, so there's not chaos happening in the session, the conversations sometimes carry a lot of chaos. And so I try to balance that out with things that are very peaceful and very soothing for me. Yeah, so like reading, listening to podcasts, all of that stuff. But if I'm being transparent, it goes up and down, it ebbs and flows. Yeah. How about you, Zandra? That was a good question.
Yeah.
No, talking about this reminded me, that's the reason why I asked, because it reminded me of one time when I had such a heavy session, a very heavy, probably one of the heaviest I had. And I had all this, I don't know, energy that needed to be processed. And I look at my schedule. Okay, I just finished this session. I don't have a session for another, I think I had a break of 2 hours. I put my running shoes and I literally went for a run until I felt like I was processing. It was a very therapeutic moment for me.
Yeah.
I finished and I was able to keep going. But yeah, that was a tough one. Yeah.
Yeah. Running is a good way, that physical like exertion to get that like adrenaline out of your system. Actually, there's a book about it called The Burnout Cycle, and phenomenal book. I highly recommend it. But it talks about closing that circle. Like at the end of your day, you have to do something, even if it's just like walking or stretching, like you have to physically get it out of your body. So sounds like you did it for the level of like how heavy it was.
As well, one of the things I will always take with me, my running shoes, because if I cannot run, at least I can walk on it. So.
Yeah.
That was really good, Sandra. Yeah, I think sometimes you'll see things, I don't know if you guys do, on social media where people will write like, you do this because you get paid to do it, stuff like that. And in all honesty, it's if we if I chose a profession based off of that, it wouldn't be this.
Yeah. No, it
Oh, it would be psychiatry.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, my therapist said something about that this week. She quoted Ted Lasso. Have you guys ever seen that show? This psychologist in that show, she's a sports psychologist, is talking to Ted Lasso, and he says, "Well, you're just doing this for the money." And she said, "Do you love what you do?" And he said, "Of course I do." And she said, "Would you do it for free?" And he said, "No, I wouldn't do it for free." She's, "I love what I do, but I wouldn't do it for free." So that's like exactly where we're at. Like you still have to earn a living. Like we have to pay rent and our bills and stuff like that. So where would you get it? Oh.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, no, like, not at all. I wish I could put into words what I feel sometimes in those rooms with clients. Like, it's a beautiful feeling. It really
It
is.
is.
Yeah, it really is. Not too long ago, this client said something, and I had to, of appreciation, and which doesn't happen often, but that's okay. And virtual one. And I had to quickly get off because I just lost it, like absolutely lost it because, yeah, I just, it was like, it was a good, it came at the right time, and it was a good, like, a reminder, yeah, of like the impact that we have and like the role that we play in people's lives. Yeah. And it, just talking about stuff like this and the heaviness of it and how we provide people an opportunity to just like unload. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like it out there.
Yeah, I actually keep a little journal of moments like that where clients will either show appreciation or something big happens. I keep it HIPAA, like I'll just say client said this, and then it's just like a good reminder. I can flip through and be like, okay, that was good. Like I'm doing good things. But yeah, it keeps me motivated.
Yeah, it's funny. I think I was super awkward, actually. I was like, yeah,
Weird. It's weird to get a thank you.
listen, we have our own problems too, right?
Yeah.
Accepting compliments. Oh, man. I enjoyed this talk with you guys. I really did.
Yeah, me too.
I'm excited about our next one. So, the next one we'll be talking about. Nobody, what is it? Nobody wants this, right?
Yes, nobody wants this.
Yeah.
Yeah, very popular one.
I'm excited about that. Awesome. Thanks for watching. And as always, keep reflecting.